Let me remind you what we did yesterday during the second part of the lecture. We started to quantize the scalar free field. Free field that describes a particle with mass m using the techniques, the method of path integral, which becomes in that case a functional integral. Integral quantization. And so, since the classical action of the free field, or the free field is just a scalar field 5x real, since the classical action of the scalar field is the integral over d dx of minus 1/2 of minus d mu phi, d mu phi minus m squared phi. Remember that I am using the metric minus d t squared plus d x squared. Then we have to compute a functional integral over field configuration weighted by the usual Feynman phase factor exponential of height over h bar times the classical action for any field configuration. Okay? And we can define similarly an Euclidean, so this is at real time, and we have seen that, in fact, it's interesting to consider what's happening at Euclidean time, where the Euclidean action is so this is Euclidean, now, space-time coordinates, and then this becomes d mu phi, d mu phi plus m squared over 2 pi squared, where the Euclidean element is just dxe squared. Okay? And then the Euclidean is just path integral, is just the exponential of minus 1 over h bar the Euclidean action. So this is real time. And the corresponding integral for Euclidean. And we have also discussed the fact that in order to define in a proper way what this means, we, in fact, the best idea is to discretize space-time. For instance, from going from a continuum space-time to a lattice. With a mesh, finite mesh for space and finite mesh for time, and to take the continuum limit where both delta t goes to 0 and delta x goes to 0. Okay? So now, of course, this is very formal. I haven't shown you that whether this functional integral exists, and I haven't shown you whether it gives the correct result. So that's what we are going to do now. So first, we could try to compute matrix element of evolution operator. But that's quite a complicated, and there are a lot of subtleties in defining what is the evolution operator for a field configuration, because for the following reason. Remember, in quantum mechanics, to define the path integral, we need, the most convenient way is to use the position states that are the eigenstates of the position operator, okay, which tells you that a particle is located at a point, given point x at a given time. So that's for quantum mechanics. If you want to go to quantum field theory, the analog of a position state is a field configuration state. It's a field configuration phi, where phi is in fact means the data of a given configuration of the field. So it's a field configuration. Configuration on a given time slice. So we fix time and we consider what is the configuration of the field for all the value of all the possible value of the position. Basically, we are studying a field configuration along such a time slice. And in fact, and then we have to consider all the possible field configurations. So to any given classical field configuration at fixed time correspond a state in the Hilbert space. But that's this set of states is quite complicated, because in fact, as we shall see later, the fields that count and that makes out a basis of the Hilbert space viewed in the field space are very wild fields. So it's you have a lot of there are subtleties. So it's better, in fact, to try to construct and to reconstruct what you did in the QFT1 course. Matrix element of some operators created out of the creation and annihilation operator of the one particle states out of the vacuum. So we have the vacuum state. Let us call it zero. The vacuum state, or omega, if you prefer. So how can we construct the vacuum state out of a functional integral? We saw how we can do that in the general framework of path integral. We saw that in order to do the vacuum state, you have to start from the path integral at Euclidean time. To take, consider a periodic Euclidean time with tau beta equal h bar of with some period tau beta, periodic Euclidean time, and to take the limit tau beta equal infinity. So consider really that Euclidean time is infinite, and in that way we automatically, if you compute properly what we are interested in, we compute the matrix element of some observable. Okay. So that's what we are going to do. From this correspondence principle that we have seen in the discussion of the path integral for quantum mechanics yesterday, we have seen that inserting a q at some given time t in the path integral amounts to compute matrix element of the operator, the quantum operator q at a given time t, where this is defined by the Heisenberg picture. Okay, so inserting a classical variable amounts to consider a quantum operator. So there is a correspondence principle between the classical variable in the path integral and the some corresponding quantum operator. Here, we integrate over the phi, some classical variable phi of x. See, we are integrating over all the possible field configuration. So there should be the same correspondence principle. To inserting a phi at some given point of space-time should correspond to creating, looking at matrix element of a quantum operator phi at point x of space-time, where phi is a field operator. And you have seen in the QFT one course that you can define a field operator out of creation and annihilation operator. So the question is the field operator obtained by, so let me call this a capital phi to denote that this is an operator while this is a random variable. So does the field operator obtained by inserting phi, some phi's, in the path integral or the functional integral, does this reproduce the field operator that you have been studying and constructing in the canonical formalism? So is it the same? And we shall see that indeed this is the same. So that's, so in some sense the path, the functional integral is a very simple and direct way to construct the field operator, the field operator, quantum operator. So that's what we are going to do. And for that, that's quite simple. So let us just start from the Euclidean time formulation, because that's easier to do the calculation, and then we shall do a Wick transformation, remember, to go back to the real-time theory, the physical theory. So the idea is, insert some phi of x1, phi of xn, and in the Euclidean path integral. So, yes?
So this field operator, in some sense, tells you the probability amplitude for a particular field configuration?
It's an operator. It's the analog of the position operator in quantum mechanics.
Okay.
But
wasn't Q doing that job?
Well, that's what we saw yesterday.
Yeah. So what does it tell us that when we insert, what is the job of this field operator?
Well,
it creates
out of the vacuum, for instance, some state in the Fock space. And what we are going to do is, which operator is this operator, and is it the same operator than the operator you studied in QFT1 by canonical quantization? I'm going to show just that this is the same operator you construct in different ways. So what I'm going to compute is in the Euclidean path integral, remember, I'm Euclidean path integral, not path integral, but functional integral. I'm going to compute the expectation value of phi at two points of space-time. So I have my Euclidean space-time with x naught, which is tau, and x mu that are the space coordinates. So x is, so I have two points, x1 and x2 here. So those are little x, let us say, and x. Okay. And I want to compute via the functional integral what is the expectation value of this. So what does expectation value mean? It means simply that I'm taking the functional integral over phi in Euclidean setting, exponential of minus 1 over h bar, the Euclidean action for this field configuration, and in this integral, I insert the products of the value of phi at point x1 times the value of phi at point x2. Okay? And I normalize that by the partition function, namely just the functional integral without inserting those operators. Okay. So that's the analog of what I explained yesterday for the quantum mechanical path integral. Okay, so I define this to be the expectation value of the product of two fields at two points. Okay? Or usually we speak about simply of a two points function. Okay. So how do we compute this? In fact, it's very easy to compute this because remember that SE is a quadratic form in phi. So this is a Gaussian integral. We are computing integral. And then you simply have to remember what you have learned in the front-end lectures on Gaussian integration. I think this was done by Dan.
By Dennis.
And also what you learned about Green's function and operator acting on function. You have all the tools now to do the calculation. Okay. So simply because SE, remember, I will rewrite SE. Simply as integral d dx phi of x, well, there is a factor 1/2, and minus the scalar Laplacian plus m squared phi of x, which is where this is d over d, well, this is d mu. Okay, so this is a Laplace operator. So I've just performed an integration by part. So in fact, you have some boundary term, but they are unimportant. You have to be a bit careful of what are the boundaries of your space-time. Okay, so you see that written like that, this is just an operator. Here we have an operator, and here we have the product of two fields. So this integral is very similar to something like, let us write d products of d phi I e minus 1/2 phi I a g phi g times phi I1 phi I2 divided by an integral d phi I e minus 1/2 phi I a I g phi g, where phi I are the component of an n dimensional vector, and I I g are the component of an n by n matrix. Let us say symmetric positive. Okay? So this is just a generalization to an infinite dimensional space of a Gaussian integration. And you know that this is simply the expectation value of a product of phi I 1, phi I 2, using, and you know that this is simply given by the matrix element I 1, I 2 of the inverse matrix of phi. Okay. So, similarly, this object will be given simply by the matrix element of the inverse of the operator minus Laplacian plus m squared. So, by this analogy, this implies that phi of x1, phi of x2 will be given by, well, we can take the notation, we take the inverse of the operator minus lambda Laplacian plus m squared, and we take its matrix element between point x1 and point x2. You see? Okay, so let us call this function g of x1 and x2. So what does it mean that this is inverse? It means simply, as you have seen in this front-end lecture, that this means that this function g of x1 and x2 obeys the differential equation minus the Laplace operator with respect to, let us say, x1. Well, this should be rather x2 and x1 if we are going to be consistent, but that's not important. So we take this operator, we apply it to this function, okay, which is the inverse of this operator, and what should we get? We should get the matrix element of the operator identity in the same way that I minus 1, I1, I2 times A of I, well, let us set I2, I1, and I3, I2, with Einstein notation, with the sum over those indices, is equal to delta of I3, I1. So this should be, in this case, the Dirac delta function of x2 minus x1. Okay? So g of x2, x1 is just the green function of the operator minus delta plus m squared. Okay? So, you don't have to perform in detail the functional integral. Just use the fact that the functional integral is a Gaussian integral, and you get the form of this function. Okay? So, that's quite easy. So, let me remind you just some properties of this object. First, you can very easily see that g of x2, x1 is just a function of x2 minus x1. Well, that's basically because this operator commutes with the translation. That's translation invariance. It's in fact also a function only of the modulus the vector x2 minus x1, that's because of rotation invariance. This operator commutes with the rotation, so that's because the rule makes Euclidean invariance. And the best way to study it is to take its Fourier transform. Fourier transform, let us call it g hat of k, where k will be a d-dimensional covector dual to x1 minus x2, because if we define this as an integral over d dx of exponential of minus I k dot x times g of x, remember x is a vector x mu equals 0 to d minus 1. K is a covector k k mu, mu equals 0, d minus 1, and xk means k mu, x mu. Yes?
What are the boundary conditions for the Green's function in this case?
Okay, I'm going to precise that in a few minutes. If you want to have no boundary terms, then the best way in the boundary condition is to take boundary condition, take x0 to be periodic with some period t, take the other x component of x to be periodic with a period L. So it means that space-time is taken to be your Euclidean space-time is to be a torus with size t times L times L. And in that case, you have no boundary terms because you can integrate by parts. You have no boundaries. You have no boundary terms. But so in this case, the equation makes sense. You can define everything. And then take the limit t and L goes to infinity. So remember, finite Euclidean, well, periodic Euclidean time means we are working at finite temperature. And of course, periodic space-time means that space-time is a torus itself. So this limit means projecting on the ground state and taking space to be infinite. Okay. And with this boundary condition, you are on firm ground when you do the calculation. Okay. And with this boundary condition, one can see very easily that it implies that the function g of x decays at infinity. Because it has to be periodic, but so since it's very far, it means that it decays at infinity. So this will be the boundary condition for this equation. Okay? Good. So, if we take the Fourier transform, then it's very easy that this equation for the Fourier transform becomes becomes k squared plus m squared times g, the Fourier transform g hat of k equal 1, because the Fourier transform of the delta function is the identity function, and the Fourier transform of these operators becomes a local function in Fourier space. So, g hat of k is just 1 over k squared plus m squared. So it's a Lorentzian distribution in momentum space. So k is a momentum variable. Well, it's not exactly momentum, but it's a dual variable of x. So it's a conjugate variable. So it plays a role of a moment. Okay. So that's it. And therefore, g of x is just the inverse Fourier transform. And with our notation, this is dd of k over 2 pi to the power d exponential of I k dot x. So this is the scalar product of k times x times 1 over k squared plus m squared. Okay? Well, you have many way to compute that. In fact, one knows the solution of that also. One can show it explicitly because, for instance, using the fact that this is invariant by rotation, you write that this is a function only on R, the modulus of x. So you can also write that since g of x is a function g of r with r equal modulus of x. So then this equation becomes simply d squared over d, well, minus d squared over ds squared plus d minus 1 over r d over r d over r. So this is the radial part of the Laplacian operator, plus m squared of g of r equal, well, something which let us say is delta of r, but one has to be a bit more careful, but some, basically it's zero except at the origin. One has to be a bit more careful. And you can show that the correct, so this is just a well-known second order linear differential equation whose solution are the Bessel functions. And with this boundary condition, the fact that it decays at infinity, one can show that the solution is, I'm sorry, I will erase this a little bit. The solution is g of r equal, well, with the normalization, the gamma function of the dimension of space minus 2 divided by 2 divided by 4 times pi d over 2 times r. R is a modulus of the vector times 2 minus d. So this is the explicit solution. So this is the representation of this two-point function in Fourier space, in momentum space. And this is the explicit solution in... That's more complicated. This is a special case. I'm sorry. Forget at the moment for that, because of course the mass plays a role. So the solution is 1 over 2 pi, 2 pi r over m to the power 2 minus d over 2 times a Bessel function of second kind, k d minus 2 over 2 of r times m. Okay, so this is the explicit form. So this is called k nu of z is a Bessel function of second type. Look on your handbook on special functions on the web, and that's some special function that precisely obeys an equation related to this one. Okay, good. Okay, and one important thing. What I wrote before is a limit when the mass goes to zero of g of r. This was a gamma of d minus 2 over 2, 4 times pi d over 2 times r to the power 2 minus the dimension. So this is the massless case, the case where the field has the mass in the action has no form. Okay, so remember, we still are in Euclidean space. So there are two properties very important of this function. The large distance behavior. If m is positive, g of r behaves like exponential of minus rm. And that comes out from the large distance behavior of this function. But this comes out from the fact that at large distance, if you write this equation, this term is unimportant. So this behaves like minus d squared over dr squared plus m squared of g of r equals 0, whose solution is exponential plus or minus mr. And exponential plus r is forbidden because of the boundary condition. So it can only be an exponential of minus rm. So there is an exponential decay in Euclidean space, remember. Okay. Now, what about the short distance behavior? What's happening when r goes to 0? Well, when r goes to 0, either you take start from this expression and look at what's the behavior of the Bessel function when r goes to 0, or take directly the behavior of the massless function, because when r goes to 0, on the contrary, you can see that this term are important and this term is unimportant. You see, at short distance behavior, you can set m equals 0, because the mass will be a small correction at short distance. Because remember, short distance means large momenta. Large momenta means that 1 over k squared dominates with respect to m squared. Okay? And then you see that g of r behaves like r2 minus d. Okay? So it's singular if d is larger than 2, because this power is negative. And in fact, if you take this function and take the limit when d equals 2, this is the Euler gamma function. If you write a little bit, you realize that this behaves also like logarithm of r. So it's also singular when d equals 2. In all cases, this function is singular. Okay? This function diverges at short distance. Okay? Good. So now, of course, we computed the propagator in Euclidean space. In real space, real time, so in Minkowski spacetime, well, you can play the same game. Simply replace this by I over h bar, the action. It's still a Gaussian integral. So then it will now be this function g of x2 or x1, x2 will be still a solution of such a differential equation when you replace the Laplace operator in Euclidean space by the Laplace operator in Minkowski space. And if you walk out a little bit, you see that the Laplace operator will become minus d squared over dt squared plus, plus minus d over dx mu squared, the gradient, plus m squared of g of x. Well, now x is t x equal, and this delta means a product of delta t. So remember, we had the tau equal i t. So delta of tau, delta of x means delta of tau times product from mu equal 1 to d minus 1 delta of x mu in Euclidean space. So delta of tau becomes delta of t times 1 over I. So this becomes minus I delta of x, where x is the vector in Minkowski spacetime. And you recognize the equation that defines the propagator in quantum field theory. So this is the equation that defines the propagator of the free field in canonical quantization. Okay? Now, a bit subtle, which propagator? Is it the advanced propagator? Is it the retarded propagator? Is it the Feynman propagator? Well, the answer is in fact that g of x is the Feynman propagator. And there are several ways to view that. One way is to say that the solution has to be symmetric between past and future. But the best way is to just start from this equation. Start from g of x. Let me write this in Euclidean and write it as, let me write this by stating that k is some k naught and some special k vector in Euclidean space. Remember, xe is tau x, and ke is some k naught and k. Okay? And let us perform a Vick rotation. To perform a Vick rotation means that I don't do anything on the x and k component, but I make a rotation in complex place on tau. So I start from a tau, which is like that, which goes from zero, and the Vick rotation means that I write that tau equal it. So t is the imaginary part of tau. So I make a transformation like that on my contour of integration. You know, I write that g e of x is integral d tau over 2 pi integral d. No, I'm sorry, dk naught over 2 pi dk over 2 pi to the power d minus 1, exponential of I k naught tau plus k x 1 over, and what is k squared? This is k naught squared plus k squared plus m squared. Okay? And now I try to make an analytic continuation of this function. This function is a function of tau and x. And I want to make this Vick rotation in the complex plane. For tau. Well, if I make that, I must perform a rotation on k naught, because if tau gets an imaginary part, and if I don't make anything on k naught, I have an exponential of I with something which should grow at plus or minus infinity. So if I make this rotation, I must make, let us say, a counter Vic rotation on K naught, on X on K naught. But that's allowed because K naught is just an integral. We integrate over K naught. So it means that simply that we must change the contour of integration. We must rotate on the integration contour. Of K naught. So which rotation? I must rotate it in the other way so that this becomes, this is still just a pure phase. So what I should perform is that, remember, at the beginning, in the integration I am integrating over K naught. So this is the original tau. This is the final t. The original contour of integration of k naught is like that. I must rotate it like that. So that it becomes a contour of integration like that. You see? So, let me write this as, here this Vic rotation was to write tau equal it. Then the similar contour integration will be that I will write k naught equal 1 over I times omega, where omega, so t is real time. Omega will be a real frequency. Okay? And then this becomes, of course, integral d omega over 2 pi dk over 2 pi to the power d minus 1 exponential of I omega t plus kx 1 over, and then I get a minus omega squared because omega is I times k naught plus k squared plus m squared. You see? So the and in addition, of course, I have an I factor here.
With a minus sign.
Because
with a minus.
Minus sign.
Pardon?
With a minus sign as well.
Because 1 over I.
Yes, but k naught is 1 over I omega.
Yeah.
So omega is I k. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Yes, you are right. Minus I. Thank you. Okay. So this seems okay, but simply remember that now that k naught, this function, has poles at k naught equal plus or minus I k squared plus m squared. So this function has poles. Let us find a new color. It has a pole here. And it has a pole here. When you deform this contour of integration like that, what do you get as a contour? You get as a contour which goes like that, like that, like that, like that, like that. Okay? So now, rewrite this as a contour in the omega plane. Omega, sorry, this is omega. So now this is k naught. I just make a rotation. The poles are here. And the contour of integration is this one. This is a contour of integration. This is the integration contour. For the Feynman propagator. See? Hence, this object. Okay? So, starting from the computing the two-point function in Euclidean space, making a weak rotation to go back to Minkowski space, we get the Feynman propagator. Why is it natural? Well, very easy to see. I'm sorry. No, that's what I want to say. In fact, that's what we are going to expect. Yes?
Can you explain again why we did the counter-rip rotation in the K-notch?
That's because I want that K-not tau to be real, whatever the when I make performing the weak rotation. So I replace, if I replace tau by EI theta some t with theta going from 0 to pi over 2, then I make a rotation k naught to e minus I theta omega with the same theta, so that this is still real. If it's not real, it means that when I integrate over omega for this real, if this theta prime is different from if I have another angle, then the integral doesn't converge because I have an exponential with a growing part either at plus infinity or minus infinity. So the only consistent way to apply Cauchy theorem and to deform the contour of integration is to do that, okay? So, now, why do we expect that? Yes?
How does this naturally lead to this particular contour in this case?
Simply because if I rotate, well, let me draw this again. I have a function that has two poles, one here, and one here. I start with an integration contour for Euclidean frequency, which is like that. Now I want to make this rotation by an angle theta. So I rotate this contour by an angle theta. It becomes such a contour. You see, if I continue up to theta equal pi, then what I get a contour that is like that. This pole is to the right and this pole is to the left of the contour. Okay?
Yeah, but what I'm saying is there are four possible ways you can go over. And
yes, but when doing this weak rotation, you get this particular choice. You don't get, you know, if you want to go to this one, you deform the contour and you pick the residue of the contour. So you are not computing the same integral.
Yeah.
You are adding something, which indeed makes you transform this Feynman propagator into another integral. That gives another propagator. In that case, it's I don't remember if it's the retarded or the advanced propagator. You see? Okay. So now, why is it natural? Remember, at real time, inserting two operators in the path integrals gives the time ordered products of these operators. We have seen that in the path integral formalism. So this principle, which comes out just from the mathematical structure, applies to our infinite dimensional functional integral. So it means that we started from phi of x1, phi of x2 in Minkowski space. What we expect by Vick rotation is that we get the vacuum expectation value of the products of the two corresponding field operator, capital phi at point x1, capital point phi at point x2. But not, remember, those operators do not commute. What the path integral formalism built is the time order product of those two operators. Remember, in the canonical quantization, for instance, you have seen that, in fact, this operator is, of course, defined as an operator that depends both on time and on spatial coordinates. You have seen that those operators, phi of x1 and phi of x2, do not commute if t squared is larger than x squared. They do commute only if t squared is smaller than e squared, so that the two points are causally separated. Well, commute, so this is space and future and the past cone. And then time-ordered product is it. This is phi of x1, phi of x2, if t1 is larger than t2. This is phi of x2, phi of x1, if t1 is smaller than t2. And in fact, if we are in in the future cone, in the main cone, and whatever it is, if we are in the space region, because then they commute. Okay?
No, we saw in QFT that there's a problem on defining time ordering at equal times, or basically commutation relations at equal times. This arises from the fact that in Euclidean time you have this divergence.
Yes, precisely. That's related. The fact that you have problems in defining the commutator, you see it in this calculation. There is a singularity, in fact. The singularity at r equals 0 comes from the fact that I have a second term here. Good. So let me just now show you, elaborate a little bit on this aspect. And then I will just show you some picture. So the question is, where does this singularity come from? As you pointed out very cleverly, the fact that there is a singularity, well, that's not completely true. Well, the fact that there are singularities comes out from the fact that the commutation relation have a second term when you are at coinciding on the light cone. But there is more than that. The fact that this diverge is peculiar to the fact that you are in two dimension, or in three dimension, or in four dimension. So these divergences do not occur in one dimension. And remember, you can view a one-dimensional quantum field theory as just a quantum mechanical system. You just have time. You do not have space. Space coordinates are not on the same footing than time coordinate for a non-relativistic system. So in fact, the space coordinate in a quantum mechanical system like the harmonic oscillator is just the phi variable. See? So this divergence comes out from the fact that there's something special happens in dimension 2 or in dimension 3. So what is it? So I have some picture. I hope it will work. Yes. Let's see what's going on. Perhaps we should switch off some lights. Oh, yes. Oh, thank you. So let me show you some typical field configuration that occurs in this path integral. In this path integral, well, at Euclidean time, you can do the same analysis in Minkowski space, but in Euclidean time, this is just a probability density distribution on field configuration. And so we may ask, for this probability distribution on field configuration, what are the field configuration phi that are dominants, that are typical? I hope. Yes. Okay. So first, remember, in d equal 1 dimension, d equal 1 means d equal 1 means we are considering phi is phi of t plays the role of q of t, the position for an harmonic oscillator. Okay? Because the action replaced in one dimension phi by q, you get the action of the harmonic oscillator. So in the harmonic oscillator, what are the typical trajectory in Feynman path integral? Well, we have arc that it's somewhat singular, but in fact, here are they. These are random walks. They correspond to what mathematicians and physicists call this a Brownian walks. Well, some mathematicians call this a Brownian process. And some other one calls it the Wiener process, but that's just a name. Here are a set of typical configurations that are present in the path integral in one dimension for the probability amplitude going from this point to this point as a function of time. So these are typical Brownian motion. And see, the Brownian motion are known to be functions that are continuous, but they have no derivative. The derivative is infinite at each time. So the speed is not the instantaneous velocity of the particle is infinite, but it's plus or minus infinite at almost any time, so that on the average, the velocity is finite, but the fluctuations are infinite. But it's still a continuous function. OK? Now let's see what's the analogous of this samples in two dimensions. So let me consider this, the field variable. You know, in this case, the mathematician call the typical configuration the Gaussian free field. So the probability person exponential of minus the action for a free field gives a probability object called the Gaussian free field. So as we have seen, we see that it's a very singular object. But as I explained at the beginning of the course, we can define this properly by working on the lattice, making space and time discrete. And then we can take the limit when the mesh of this lattice goes to zero. So here is a typical configuration for a two-dimensional free field in Euclidean space-time. I took space-time to be periodic in both directions in order to have a finite samples. And here we have a 64 by 64 lattice. So the mesh basically is 1 over 64. And here is a typical configuration. You see that the typical field is very wild. But you could say, OK, it's just a two-dimensional Gaussian process. In order to see what are the properties of this, what you need to do is to refine the mesh. So let us take a mesh twice as smaller. You see, it becomes more spiky. Take it, divide it by two. It's even more spiky. Divide it by two, it starts to be very, very spiky. And that reflects, that's the geometrical visualization of the fact that you have those divergences. In fact, it becomes infinitely spiky when the mesh becomes zero. So in fact, this means, the fact that there is a divergence means that the expectation value of phi of x from phi of x is always infinite in dimension two. You see? So that's very different from a Brownian walk, where the value of the position at a given time is well defined. The derivative is not well defined, but the value is definite. So this is very different from. So in fact, a typical phi, of x is not continuous. In fact, it is not a function because its typical value at any point is zero. So it's not just that it jumps. It's really something which is not a function. It's a mathematical object called a distribution. In the sense of Schwarz. I think you have been also, you also got had a starter course on distribution. So this is a typical example of a distribution that is very wild everywhere. But as a mathematical object, it is well defined. Yes?
Can you clarify what you mean by typical? Like, do you mean the average, or do you mean just like if you sample from the space?
It means you take a sample. In the for mathematicians, it means you take a sample. And in fact, that's what I did. I ran a numerical, there was some trick, but that's typically run a numerical simulation by some Monte Carlo algorithm, for instance, of this distribution, and pick a typical sample. That's what how it looks like. Yes?
So these are not distributions, right? How do you define the multiplication between two distributions?
When you cannot multiply the multiplication between two distributions, as you probably know,
right,
in general. And that's indeed the case. You cannot multiply the distribution phi by the multiplication phi at the same point.
Right.
You get always infinite.
Right, but even if I have two different points, you're defining that multiplication between the two distributions.
But then what you are defining is, in some sense, the convolution of two distributions. You know, if you want to define phi of x1 times phi of x2, you start from a distribution in x into a distribution in x1, x2, belonging to R squared. So basically, out of a distribution, you construct a scalar product of two distributions in a bigger space. And that's perfectly, that's allowed, you see. So this is, in some sense, a tensorial product of a distribution by itself. Why phi squared? This doesn't work. Okay.
And another thing with respect to what we did here, we just showed that the correlation function in Euclidean time is related to the correlation function of the real time, right?
Yes.
But how does the operators arise in here? We just calculated something and we compared with something that we knew
yes.
from before. But I don't see from this where do the commutation relations come from, or how to basically say that the two fields commute if there is space-like separator, or they don't commute if they are not.
Well, you have to compute more matrix element of this operator and check that for any states. Here, I've been computing, what I've been computing is omega, some phi, omega. So, and in fact, you can check that this works for that case. But what you have to compute is, in general, some psi, some, let us say, some out state, phi, phi, in state. And if you have a relation that phi, phi equals something that is valid for all in and all out states, you know to compute. You compute this by path integral methods. And if you check that this relation is valid for any in and out state, then this means that this is true as an operator relation. So for doing that, you need to compute more object. But you construct ints by applying products of phi to the vacuum state. So you will see, you know, I won't have time to treat that today, but what we are going to do tomorrow is to show how you compute out of the two-point function correlation function involving more than two phi operator. In fact, you know already the answer. You have studied that in the canonical formalism, and it's given by Vick's theorem. And what I'm going to show, well, perhaps I can explain that today. Vick's theorem also holds in the functional integral formalism. Okay, but let me just go back to that, because here is a typical configuration in two dimension. Now you can do the same thing in three dimension. Again, it's quite irregular, and if you refine the mesh, of course, I took a typical a sample of a free field in three dimension. It's difficult to represent it on a screen, so I took a section, a two-dimensional section of my three-dimensional space, and what I represent is the value of the feed on this two-dimensional section. So here is in refined, and as you refine the mesh, you see that it becomes also very spiky, and in fact, it's become much more spiky in three-dimension than in two-dimension. You can measure correlation function, but this comes from the fact simply that here you see that the divergence is much stronger in three dimensions than in two dimensions. So the higher the dimension, the more singular the typical distribution of a Gaussian field is. In four dimensions, it will be even more singular, in five dimensions. So the higher in dimension, the more irregular and singular a quantum field, in a sense, in the functional integral is. Okay? Okay. Okay. Perhaps I can just show you. This is just an illustration, but that to discuss what you see. Here is a representation of the propagator. So this function g of r in Euclidean space. So it's given by this function. So in fact, it's a function that decays at infinity and that has a singularity, a peak at zero. So this is in Euclidean space. If you make the Vick rotation to see how the Feynman propagator looks like, well, this is in two dimensions. Of course, the Feynman propagator has is complex, so in general it has a real part and an imaginary part. If you plot it, the real part is somehow regular in the space region. This is the future cone, this is the past cone, where it has oscillation, which represents the fact that you have the mass, you have quantum state that propagates. You have a singularity here that are causal singularity on the light cone, and you have this singularity, this one, at the origin. So you have two kinds of singularities. You have the causal singularities, and you have this short distance singularity at the origin. And for the imaginary part of the Feynman propagator, but I presume you studied it in QFT1, but this is a nice visualization. The imaginary part of the Feynman propagator vanishes in the space-like region. It is non-zero in the future and in the past cone. They are complex conjugates because it is symmetric, the Feynman propagator. And the fact that there is an imaginary part here, and the fact that there is an imaginary part here, and there is no imaginary part, in fact, reflects the causal properties of the Feynman propagator. Okay? Good. And well, we started a bit late, so let me give myself one more 5 minutes. Well, 5 more minutes. How do I switch this off? Exit, perhaps? No. Well, I know how to. Yes. So finally, this is rear. Yes. Now imagine that we want to compute correlation function of 4 points. Or function, let's say. Okay? It means simply that we have to compute a product of 4 random Gaussian variables. Okay. And there is a general theorem for Gaussian variables, which states, for instance, go back to this integral that gives you defined expectation value of a set of finite Gaussian variables. It tells you that if you want to compute phi 1, well, let's phi I 1, phi I 2, phi I 3, phi I 4, if this is Gaussian, and of course, if each phi I is equal to 0, so that the Gaussian is centered at the origin. This is simply given by phi of I1, phi of I2, times phi of I3, phi of I4, plus the same thing, phi of I1, phi of I3, phi of I2, phi of I4, plus phi of I1, phi of I4, phi of I2, phi of I3. So in general, it is given by the sum of all pairings of the 4 variables into the products of the 2 points correlation. And that's a general theorem, mathematical theorem, that is easy to prove, and I presume you have seen it, for Gaussian variables. You say, of course, this is nothing but Wick's theorem in the functional integral setting. Because if you apply this general theorem to this, you see that this is given by phi of x1, phi of x2, times phi of x3, phi of x4, plus x1, x3, x2, x4, plus x1, x4, x2, x3. Okay. So you see that just the fact that the path integral, functional integral, is Gaussian implies this simple relation between the four-point function and the two-point function, which is exactly mathematically the same relation than the relation between vacuum expectation value of products of operator or green functions. The same, so this is the same than same relation, that the same relation than for green function in canonical quantization. Okay. And since this is true in this Euclidean setting, it's also true in the real-time setting, the seed Gaussian integrals. And you know that you recover the Feynman propagator. So you have a direct proof of the Vick theorem for this non-interacting free scalar field without using commutation relation of creation and annihilation operator and the fact that you are dealing with time order products. You see. The fact that the path integral, the functional integral, is a Gaussian integral, and the fact that by Vick rotation, the general principle of, well, the general formulation of path integrals means that you automatically recover a vacuum expectation value of time ordered products of operator makes the job. You see? Okay. And of course, this, we'll come back to that tomorrow. This is true for any products of operator. In general, if you take the products of 2n, 2n functions, you get the sum over all the pairings of the products of n two-point functions. Because it's a general property coming from Gaussian integration. Okay. And in fact, doing that, we have an answer to your question. Because now I can construct all the initial and final states in the Hilbert space of the state of the quantum field by applying an arbitrary number of phi operator to the vacuum state. I can compute, I can insert in addition commutators of phi, so that here, if I have p phi, q phi here, and 2 phi here, I have p plus q plus 2 products of phi. I compute them using Vick theorem, and that's going to take some time if you are careful. But and you can check that the commutation relation will be valid. Okay? You see the idea? Okay. So let's end the lecture here. And so what you have to remember is that it's possible to define a path integral. It's possible for the quantum free, the free field, the scalar free field. It's possible to compute the two-point function very easily. You recover the results of canonical quantization. You, Vick theorem is valid, of course, but here it's just a consequence of the general theorem for correlation between Gaussian random variables. And finally, important, the propagator has short distance, what is called ultraviolet singularities. So, and this will become, this is a new feature of quantum field theory that, in fact, requires the theory of renormalization to be properly understood. But that's a very important feature of quantum field theory. The short distance or high energy behavior of a quantum field theory is much more singular, also much more interesting than in quantum mechanics, where at short time, nothing special happens. Apart the fact that operators do not commute. Okay. Thank you.